It's always a pleasure to be here at the Beef Improvement Federation meetings. I don't know of any other place that brings together producers, educators, extension people, students in a way that BIF does, and it makes it something really special, I think, for all of us. Let's see. I'm going to very much follow up on the comments made last night by Mark Coleman and expand on them a little bit, so I think it's going to be very much some of the same material as we think about how we integrate genetic markers into national cattle evaluation, because that's what I see this morning's program about, is making that integration. Certainly, genetic markers have the potential to improve the effectiveness of national cattle evaluation. But I have to say that for most traits, the genetic markers alone, as we have them today, are not going to account for enough of the genetic variation in the traits of interest to allow us to use the marker as the only selection criteria. We are not there, and in my opinion, we will not be there for quite some time. Instead, we're going to have methods developed to combine information from genetic markers with information from performance recording and simply use them as a way to improve and certainly not replace expected progeny differences. Before I get too deeply into how to use some of these markers, I want to talk a little bit about the different types of markers. I think it's important that we recognize that there are different types of markers, and I'm going to very closely follow the presentation that Dorian Garrick and Trisha Johnson made at the last Genetic Prediction Workshop. Three different types of markers that we have available to us. One we would call gene-assisted selection, in which the marker is actually a part of the gene we care about. And I'll have some diagrams in a minute to talk about that. We have what Dorian called linkage disequilibrium marker-assisted selection, and I'll use MAS as marker-assisted selection throughout, where the marker is not a part of the gene, but it's very close to the gene and closely linked to the gene. And then third, we have something that's been called linkage equilibrium marker-assisted selection, in which the marker is more loosely linked to the QTL. And the important distinction between these last two is with LEMAS, linkage equilibrium marker-assisted selection, the relationship between the gene and the marker is not necessarily predictable among families. Some bulls may have a marker associated with high levels of performance. Other bulls may have the same marker associated with lower levels of performance. We only know when we have tested the association in the individual bull. So here's some examples. The top, a GAS marker, part of the gene we care about. And so if we evaluate the marker, we are evaluating the animal's genotype for the gene we care about. In contrast, on the bottom of the slide, we have a marker-assisted selection marker in which the marker is associated with, but not necessarily a part of, the gene controlling the economically important trait. And so we have to account for the fact that the marker is, indeed, nothing more than an indicator of the gene we care about. Now, as the marker moves from very close to the gene, the LD, or linkage disequilibrium marker, farther away from the gene, our ability to assume that the marker, will be necessarily associated with the gene is reduced. And we move from linkage disequilibrium, where we are confident that the marker is an indicator of good performance, to a situation where we are less confident about the association between the markers. We also need to recognize that more and more we will not deal with single markers, we will deal with multiple markers, and in particular we will deal with flanking markers, where we have markers on both sides of the gene we care about, and by having markers on both sides of the gene we care about, when we find both markers present, we are much more confident that the gene we care about, the quantitative trait locus, or the QTL gene, is also present. I want to focus a lot today on judging the importance of a marker. How significant is a marker to genetic improvement? And we have about four factors that come into play in making that judgment. The first is the size of the marker effect. just how different are individuals that carry the different marker genotypes. Second, we have to deal with the degree of dominance of the marker. Are heterozygotes intermediate to the two different homozygous classes, or do they resemble one of the other marker homozygotes more closely? The marker frequency is a major issue in assessing the importance of a marker in a population or in a breed. And this is different from the way we have generally considered genetic variation. We have to ask, is this marker common? Is it rare? And what are the implications of its frequency? And finally, we have to ask the proportion of the genetic variation in the trait that can be accounted for by the marker. And this is quite important in understanding the relative significance of performance records, EPDs, versus marker genotypes. How much variation, how much opportunity for improvement in the trait of interest exists independent of the markers we have for that trait? And we'll go through each of these in a little more detail. The marker effect is normally expressed as the difference between the two homozygotes for the marker. So if we have individuals that are homozygous for what's thought to be the favorable marker, individuals that are homozygous for the alternative form of the marker, we look at the difference between those two homozygous classes, and we often represent the marker effect as something we call 2A. Individuals carrying the marker are this much above average. Individuals that do carry the alternative marker are this much below average. If we take the GeneStar marbling marker, the thyroglobulin marker, as an example, the difference in marbling score between homozygotes for that marker was reported last year to be between 3.5% and 11%. If we just take the average of that, that might suggest a difference of about 8% between the two marker genotypes. In Angus cattle, based on data on their website, the mean marbling score is about 6, and an 8% difference associated with the marker would give a marker effect of about a half a marbling score. And we can put that marker effect, and will in a couple of slides, in the context of what we can accomplish by traditional selection for marbling. The degree of dominance of the marker, again, we're asking where does the heterozygous individual sit relative to the two homozygous types? If the individuals that carry one copy of the marker are indistinguishable from individuals that carry two, then we say the marker is dominant. If the individuals that carry one copy of the marker show no improvement, we say the marker is recessive. And often, alternatively, the marker may be right in the middle of the two homozygous classes. The heterozygote for the marker may be right in the middle, in which we describe the marker as codominant. The GeneStar marbling marker has generally been presented as at least approximately codominant. And if we look at one report on the effect of the GeneStar marbling marker on percent choice, we see individuals with no copies of the marker around 57% choice, one star adding about 3%, two stars adding about an additional 4%. So we can define this as the effect of the marker in what appears to be a codominant marker. Now, a little algebra wouldn't be right if I didn't show you a little algebra. Population geneticists tend to do that. But this is some important algebra, so let's go through it a bit. How much of the variation can we account for by the marker? And I'm going to use a codominant marker as an example. If we have a recessive or a dominant marker, the equation gets a little longer, but the principles stay the same. We can ask, the variation attributed to the marker is a function of the marker effect, this difference to the marker effect, and the frequency of the marker. And it's a fairly simple little piece of algebra to do that. We can put that on a heritability scale, because most of you are familiar with the heritability scale, by taking the marker variance and defining it by the phenotypic variance. And this is, in some sense, the heritability of the marker effect in the population. It says how much of the variation in this trait can be accounted for by genetic variation at the marker. And we see again this form. And the main difference is that the frequency of the marker plays in prominently. So let's look at an example. The example I have here is a trait at which the marker is present at a frequency of 0.5. The heritability of the trait is 0.5, so this corresponds fairly well to some of the carcass quality traits that we're interested in. And I've said in a very arbitrary way that the heritability of the marker is 1/4 the heritability of the trait, which is one way of saying the marker accounts for 25% of the additive genetic variance in the trait. Now, we certainly can't predict whether that's about right, whether that's high, or whether that's low, but I think there is enough information coming from markers in different species and different traits to say that many of the markers we're going to find useful in national cattle evaluation are probably going to account for between 10 and 30% of the additive genetic variance in the traits we care about. So only, about 10 to 30% of the genetic variance in the traits we care about. There are some markers that have bigger effects. The myoglobin markers, the double muscling markers, have far bigger effects than that. But they also sort of change the whole world. If we want to increase lean growth, we could do it by introducing the myostatin markers. But do we really want that level of increase in lean growth? Because it changes everything we do. It changes our management. It changes our marketing. It changes our whole view of this. So the example I have here is a frequency of 0.5 for a trait with a heritability of 0.5, and the marker effect accounts for 25% of that heritability. Now, as the frequency of the marker changes, as we increase the frequency of the marker from 0.5 to 0.75, we see the overall effect on heritability is trivial, and indeed the marker still accounts for about 20% of the heritability in the trait. But notice, as we increase the marker's frequency, as we make genetic progress, our potential to use it for continued progress declines. And if we get the marker to a frequency of 90%, then we find that we're only accounting for maybe 10% or less of the remaining genetic variation. So markers actually can work themselves out of a job very effectively. We identify a marker, we increase its frequency in the population, and at some point it becomes uninformative because most of the animals carry the marker. And we go back. The gene star marbling, which if we think about a population with a frequency of the marker of about 0.5, the marker heritability is about 4%, suggesting that that marker accounts for maybe 11% of the additive variance in marbling. That means that almost 90% of the variation in marbling is accounted for by the other unknown genes that we either have not identified or will not be able to identify. Put another way, if we had genes with an effect equal to that of GeneStar, it would take 9 genes with that effect to define all the genetic variation in marbling. Now, that's not the way it's going to happen, because all genes don't have the same effects. Some have big effects, some have little effects. But remember that we found only about 10% of the utilizable variation in marbling if we assume the marker effect is 8% of the mean, which is actually pretty optimistic relative to some of the validation work that's been done by the Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium. And this has shown some examples of frequencies of the GeneStar in various breeds. It is generally less than 50%, which means we're going to make even a little less progress. Okay, let's move on now to a more important part of the presentation, the issues associated with marker-assisted selection. We have to think about size of effects, the importance of the effect, the mechanism of gene action, the importance of other genes, critically important, the importance of other genes, and the frequency of the favorable marker. In particular, when markers are intermediate in frequency, we move quickly.
When markers are high in frequency, they contribute relatively little. When markers are low in frequency, they have an opportunity, but we have a lag time involved, and it also raises concerns, as Mark did last night, that the marker is present in only a few animals in the breed. Are we really willing to stake our future on that small sample of animals that might carry the marker? How do we think about integrating marker information into national genetic evaluations? Because that's really what we want to do. Gene and markers are going to continue to be discovered. Many of them are going to fall by the wayside, but a few will not. We will identify useful markers. The comprehensive genotyping of animals, the genotyping of all registered animals in a breed, is maybe a possibility, but it's certainly not a reality. Partial genotyping of a few animals for a few markers is by far the more realistic scenario in the immediate future, and we're going to have to learn to live with it. I want to say very strongly, the material I'm going to present from now on is not going to have very many answers in it. It's going to try and present things we have to think about and address as an organization, as groups of breeders, as breed associations. So how might an association respond? We're effectively being told that these genetic markers today are something outside national cattle evaluation that is somehow informative and that may tell us that an animal is better or worse than the EPDs might indicate. It's very important to keep in mind that for traits that we record data on, for proven sires, the EPD is still the definitive predictor of genetic merit. It is the performance of progeny of the animal of interest. If an animal has a favorable marker, but progeny that don't perform, the EPD is still the definitive measure of genetic worth for that individual. So what might we do? Well, I think breed associations should consider explicitly identifying the genes that they consider to be important and of interest to the breed. What are the genes we care about, our breeders care about? I think you need to develop a DNA collection strategy. How are we going to acquire DNA on the animals we need DNA on? And that should be associated also with a genotyping strategy. Who gets genotyped for this array of markers, and who do we need to genotype in order to validate and document the performance of these markers? We need a validation strategy, and the National Cattle Evaluation Consortium has been actively involved in validation strategies. And then we need to incorporate the markers into national cattle evaluation. So how might we do that? I think we need to think about the genes that are important for individual breeds. They will not all be the same. They should not all be the same. They should not all be the same sorts of genes. Different breeds have different needs. This is going to be an evolving array. We can't sit down today and identify the breeds, the markers, because a new marker is going to appear tomorrow and another new marker next week. But we need to be thinking about, as breeders, what group, what subset of these markers are important to us. A DNA collection strategy, I think we need to think about simple techniques for DNA acquisition and physical storage. Hair, fluoracetate papers, things that do not require a lot of lab work up front. We don't need to be extracting DNA until we need it. We need to have the capacity to get repeated extractions of DNA to deal with new markers. We need to identify high priorities, but we should not rule out storage of blood on many recorded animals. We might want to do that. We might not. We should think about it in a serious way. For example, these FTA cards, a simple set of blood samples on a perforated card, that card could give you 8 opportunities to do a DNA analysis on the animal represented by the card. And I'm told that those cards could probably be stuck in a drawer and hung around until we need them. Same thing with hair. We don't do a lot of lab work till we need it. But we might want to set in place a DNA collection strategy that gives us the opportunity to look at DNA on a lot of animals. Similarly, we need a genotyping strategy. Breed associations need to ensure that they have access to the genotypes of the animals that represent their breed. I think they need to have the opportunity to become a repository for genotypic information. Now, yes, we have to make arrangements with the labs. We have to make arrangements with people who have the genotyping capability. But I think that the breed associations need to consider taking a much more proactive role in becoming the keeper of the genotypes, just as you are the keepers of the data. We've waited a long time for what's been called multiplex genotyping capacity, where you can take a sample, a blood sample from an individual, and genotype that animal for 20 or 30 genes and markers in a single pass. It's not quite there yet. I don't know when it will be there. I'm sure we can find a number of folks who will tell us that we are on the threshold, as we've been on the threshold of so many things for so very long. But it will probably happen. We need to develop a genotyping plan, I think, for our high-use sires. I think John Pollock in one of the Brown Bagger presentations called these the legacy sires. Let's look down the road a few cattle generations. If I've got DNA on an animal's sire, maternal grandsire, and great-grandsire, and someone says, I found this marvelous new marker, we really ought to be using it, and I have information on the ancestors of large numbers of animals in national cattle evaluation, I have data on those animals and their offspring, I have DNA stored on their daughters, I might be set up to evaluate that marker fairly quickly and in a fairly objective way. That's a capacity I think we'd like to have. Whether it's a cost-effective capacity, we'll have to decide. Validation strategies. The Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium has done an excellent job of emphasizing the importance of validation, and I just want to quickly reiterate that. New markers have to be validated. We have to make sure and independently validate the size of these markers. Presentations we just saw at breakfast acknowledged the importance of validation, provided some very nice validation data. We also want independent validation data, as do the companies that are presenting those markers. It's to everyone's advantage to know the truth and the size of these marker effects. We have to be prepared to validate markers in different breeds. We can't assume the results will be the same. We have to be prepared to validate the markers for both the traits they indicate and the correlated traits. We have to be prepared to recognize that a marker that has a very large effect on a trait like marbling or leanness may have substantial effects on other traits like cow fertility. We don't know if they will. We don't know if they'll be favorable or unfavorable. We simply have to look. And genotyping strategies and DNA collection strategies can be designed to support these validation strategies. We know very little about how we will actually integrate marker information into national cattle evaluation. It's going to be one of the really exciting steps of the next decade, probably, about how we will actually get this done. We do know that marker information will continue to evolve. We will always be behind. There's going to be new markers all the time. So we have to be able to continuously incorporate those markers into national cattle evaluation somehow. And I think the most important part of the breed association response is to take greater responsibility and control for the use of markers and the information generated from markers within your respective breeds. I think that's really the exciting part of this and the part we really need so that we can rapidly and efficiently validate new markers and also so that we can motivate the discovery of new markers. If docility is a really significant issue in your breed, and with the bovine gene sequence coming online very quickly, we have opportunities to direct the process of marker discovery. Especially if you have the information to support that sort of marker discovery. Now, there are a few specific issues I want to address on using markers in national cattle evaluation. They're more technical issues, but they're, and I'm going to go over them in a very sort of cursory way. How do we model marker effects? Are they fixed effects or random effects? And I know there are a number of people in the audience who thought about this one. How do we set the genetic base for our marker? Our marker-based EPD. It's got to be a function of the frequencies of the markers, and they're changing all the time. So we have to think about that. What are the effects on other traits? How do we estimate these? How do we validate marker effects in different environments, different management systems, different marketing systems? How much cross-validation is required? We have to be aware that markers may not always work. We identify a marker in a breed. We find individuals from a different family in that breed. The marker may not have the same effect in that different family. It depends a little on the nature of the marker, but there are going to be those cases, and we might as well get ready for them. And how do we handle animals that are not genotyped at all, or are genotyped only for a few markers? How do we bring the information into national cattle evaluation? I'm going to go through these kind of quickly. If the marker is fixed, then we can just make a constant adjustment to the EPD based on the presence or absence of the marker genotype. If the marker is random, then even if we know the genotype exactly, we say, well, surely every calf doesn't get a +2 marbling score bump just because it carries a marker. Does it? Or does it? Maybe it does. Then the question then becomes, if we don't consider these as fixed effects, how do we develop the random effect? Can we estimate sire by marker effects? Can we actually down the road estimate the variation among different sires in the effects of the markers they carry? Conceptually, yes. Practically, maybe. We'll have to watch that evolve. A GAS marker, a marker that actually exists within the gene, may be adequately considered a fixed effect. And I'm going to digress just a minute. There's, for those of you who've been and remember the discussions on the crossbreed EPDs, this is a lot the same discussion. Can we take breed effects out of one big, well-designed experiment and extend them to next cattle evaluation? And we largely decided that within limits we could. And this is much the same argument. Can we take a marker effect developed in a hopefully well-designed and well-validated experiment and simply apply it to EPDs? We don't know. Certainly there are other unknown sources of variation within these genes. We may have a marker that tells us something about the individual, and there may be another marker that we don't know about sitting in some families and not others. We have to prepare ourselves for things like that. They're going to happen. If we are dealing with markers that are outside the gene, we have to be prepared for the associations between those markers and the gene of interest to break down due to recombination in progeny of individual sires. So the model I have here is a pair of flanking markers, a marker on each side of the gene we care about, that indicate to us the presence of a favorable gene. And alternatively, we may have other forms of the marker that indicate to us the presence of the less favorable form of the gene. In offspring, we will have recombination events that separate the flanking markers and that leave us wondering where the gene is. It's a bit of a where in the world go exercise in genetics. And we have to be prepared to say that when these sorts of recombinations occur, when the markers we were relying on aren't together anymore, we have to have some way to predict the performance of that individual. And there are ways to do that, but right now they are fairly challenging and mathematically demanding ways to do it. Now, one of the things we've always enjoyed is computers increasing almost as fast as our imagination. Never quite, thank goodness. But we will have to deal with these possibilities. We'll have to deal with the issue of genetic base, and we'll have to watch the frequencies of the genes change and realize that as the marker approaches fixation, it becomes less informative. We will have to look at the effects on other traits. This is a major, major validation issue. How do we evaluate the significance of a marker on traits other than the trait that is, in some sense, marked? We know what's going to happen. We can immediately credit an animal for the presence of a marker, but if that marker has undesirable correlated effects, and if that has not been validated, we are going to much more slowly identify those unfavorable associations as we collect data, as we collect performance records, and as EPDs emerge. The only way we're probably going to do this well is to find a way to link the marker information with performance records. We also have to do genotyping of offspring of both sexes. You know, if I find a very large marker for lean tissue growth, I would be very happy if I had a marker database on the longevity and maternal ability and reproductive performance of the daughters of that bull, because I need that validation step. It's not going to be an easy validation step. I'd much rather be able to look back at animals we've already collected DNA on and chosen to genotype than to have to say, we better make 600 daughters and see how long they remain in the herd. We've talked about doing that before, and we know it's a lot of work. What about the animals that aren't genotyped? Many animals, maybe most animals that we have in the National Cattle Evaluation databases for the foreseeable future, will not be genotyped for all, and in fact will not be genotyped for many of these markers. We're going to need to find some way to infer the markers these individuals carry in exactly the same way we produce pedigree EPDs of calves that are not yet born. Mark Perlman has developed one methodology that will help us to infer these genotypes. There may be others. As I said, you know, the learning curve we're on is remarkably steep, but we will have to be able to develop ways to incorporate genotype and ungenotyped animals into national cattle evaluation. We'll have to do it in an efficient way, but we will have to at least make decisions about how to do it. If I make some conclusions, certainly the search for markers is going to continue for the foreseeable future. The bovine gene map is going to accelerate that search. It's going to give us some new opportunities. It's going to also give us some new complexities way beyond where we are now. The rate of discovery of gene markers is hopefully going to go up. That's why we invested in this effort. I think that if markers are going to really be used in national cattle evaluation, that we're facing a developmental effort that may rival the developmental effort involved in implementing blood EPDs. And I can say with some certainty that when we're done, the BIS guidelines are going to start getting thicker once again, because there's going to be a big chunk of how to do this. Now, I find this to be an extremely exciting development, because if I think about the time I first became involved with BIF back in the mid-70s, it was when this development of block EPD systems was really exploding onto the scene. And I think now we have an opportunity to see a new significant increase in the accuracy of the way we do business. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be frustrating.
There are going to be winners and losers. There are going to be mistakes made. But at the end of the day, I have absolute confidence that the people in this room are going to be in a better position 10 or 15 years from now to breed cattle than you are today. What track that will take, I don't know. It's going to be great fun to watch.